violence and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the Yellow Vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent, large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilized some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength. The policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race.
North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed, and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Ishkuntana and his 6-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Ishkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration, from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that is being ignored. I mean, it's been ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and he's still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizza, London.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision, and that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security, and placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Another misunderstanding between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, reportedly has been resolved. This, as it appears, a technical issue related to one of the Iranian sites has been taken care of. Iran continues its cooperation with the IAEA, but has cut back on some of its voluntary cooperation due to the United States totally leaving the JCPOA nuclear deal in 2018. However, despite Tehran's cooperation, there always seems to be some accusation by the IAEA of the Islamic Republic not abiding by its responsibilities. What is the reality? Stay with us as we take a look at this and more on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Daniel Kovalek, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh, School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Shabir Rezvi, Political Analyst, out of London. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Dan, I'd like to start off with you. I mean, there are reports that two of the most recent concerns by the IAEA have been resolved or clarified. Do you think that Tehran tries to cooperate with the IAEA, or do you see Iran lacking in trying to cooperate with the organization?
I think they do try to cooperate with the organization. And honestly, I don't really know why, given that it never satisfies anyone. It never, you know, leads to reduced sanctions. But yeah, I do think Iran, you know, acts in a very honorable way regarding the nuclear issue. Again, even though it has no obligation to do so, even though the U.S. unilaterally backed out of the nuclear deal, as was mentioned 5 years ago, and yet Iran continues to cooperate.
Well, Shabir, what about there? There seems to be continuous concern for the agency, by the agency, when it comes to Iran. When one issue is resolved, there seems to be another which appears. Do you think this is the case or not? And if so, why is this the case?
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Look, at the end of the day, I have many times been speaking on this matter and commented that the reality is that, as our colleague from Pittsburgh said, that it's really quite surprising that Iran continues to cooperate when they really don't get any mileage. One after another, issues are raised. And really, the whole nuclear issue, in my view, has been really a red herring because Iran has continuously, over the last 20-odd years, said that they are not interested in having nuclear weapons. They do not believe nuclear weapons provide any security to any nation. And they are emphatically of the view that nuclear weapons should be disbanded. So it's not really on the agenda of the Islamic Republic to have nuclear weapons. But what is important is that the IAEA and the Western powers use their leverage really for Iran not to have any defensive armament industry developed. Because recently, in the last few days, Iran tested the 2,000-kilometer ballistic missile. That, I think, is what is on the agenda, is really to disarm Iran in one way or another, leaving aside the nuclear issue, because, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has quite clearly stated that nuclear weapons are against Islam. You know, when it comes to other issues, they sort of take the speeches or the rulings of the religious scholars as sort of dangerous and extremist. But on this particular issue, when it has been continuously reiterated and explained to the Western powers that Iran is just not interested in nuclear weapons, they want to use it for civilian purposes, and which they have a right under all kinds of international rules and regulations that they can continue to do so. So whether it's for medical or other areas of civilian use, which are allowed within the current rules.
Well, Dan, how is it that Tehran is constantly being pressured and even threatened, but when the U.S. left the JCPOA, nothing was really done, nor did Washington have to pay any compensations for not sticking with its obligations? Your take on that and possible double standards in the IAEA?
Well, there's a lot of double standards here. Of course, we have also Israel that is a non-declared nuclear power with anywhere between 100 to 200, you know, nuclear warheads. We don't know how many because, again, they haven't declared it, but it's the worst-kept secret in the world that they have them, and they're not sanctioned at all. But, you know, again, we don't have a rule of law in the world. We have a rule of the mighty against, you know, the weaker countries. And the U.S. has all the military power. And, of course, it's backing Israel. And so that's why they are not sanctioned. It comes down to that, really.
Mm. Well, Shabir, do you think the agency is acting like an independent entity? Because Iran continues to tell the IAEA to not let themselves be politically manipulated. Your thoughts?
Well, this is the whole problem, that whether it's IAEA or other United Nations agencies, they really are instruments of Washington. And reality, all the sort of Western powers coalesce together with Washington on matters of this nature. So whether you take the Human Rights Body, you take the International Monetary Fund, or the World Bank, or whatever, any entity, as I said, which runs under the auspices or otherwise, really carries the line of the Washington consensus, which is really to sort of control and manipulate poorer nations, nations that are unable to stand up to the might of the United States. But I think what's also interesting is that, you know, Mr. Pompeo famously said that we lie, we cheat, and we steal. And not only that, we have a manual at the CIS to teach the cadets, and people are clapping and laughing. So that, I think, clearly shows that America and her allies lie continuously, they cheat continuously, and they steal from the poorer nations. So at the end of the day, the policy that Iran has adopted is to engage, at the same time also having the integrity to stand by its own dignity and try to manage the difficult situations that have been created due to sanctions and the manipulation of the international agencies.
Well, Dan Shabir brought up an interesting point about basically all of the organizations under the guise of the United Nations. It was created to prop up American hegemony. With that being the case, when you have certain situations, let's take the nuclear situation, we're dealing with that. I mean, what should independent countries do? Because, of course, they're going to try to use their leverage, and they will sanction, or they will, so many things that they will try to implement, if not abiding. So your thoughts on the option, the alternative of what should be done?
There's not a lot of options. That's the problem. You know, for countries that aren't as strong as the United States, and that's most countries of the world, if they act afoul of, you know, U.S. desires, whatever those may be in any given instance, they you know, risk having economic sanctions leveled against them, maybe even military action against them. And again, when you have a power like the U.S. that has the power of the sword, as we say, the power to punish other countries many times have to, you know, essentially bend to the will of the United States. And it's irrelevant what the law is. It's irrelevant what the United Nations says or any U.N. body. They just have to capitulate, whether they think that's correct or not. You know, you had this case, it should be mentioned, I think it was a couple of years ago, Iran won a case at the International Court of Justice, at least won it in part, saying some of the sanctions the U.S. has against Iran are illegal. And so the U.S. simply said, okay, we're not going to honor that decision. And by the way, we're going to just pull out generally of the ICJ, and, you know, we're going to use it when we want to and not be subject to it when we don't. You know, so again, there's no rule of law, and countries basically have to endure what they have to endure, sadly.
Hmm. Well, Shabir, at the end of the day, do you think the real goal of the West is to try to prevent Iran from advancing technologically?
But that's very clear. That has been the intention for the last 43 years. And if you look at the history of the last 43 years, that it has had continuous sanctions that have been applied so that it cannot progress economically, it cannot progress militarily, is unable to sort of create intellectual capital. But the remarkable thing is that Iran has continued to progress with all the sanctions that have been applied in the last 43 years. And, you know, it's quite incredible that it continues to progress in this manner, no matter what Washington and Washington's vassal states, I would say, want to do. But what one has to really evaluate is that, yes, USA does have a sword, and it does wield that sword continuously, either through economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, perhaps even military sanctions, regime change. These are the tools that are available within the arsenal that USA has. But, you know, what's happening globally, geopolitically and geoeconomically in the last year, 2 years, shows very clearly that what I call the vulnerable nations of the world, and that includes Russia, China, India, you know, big nations, powerful nations in their own right, are really Brazil, South Africa. They're all saying that in reality, what we have to do is to get together so that we can really stand up to the USA, because otherwise what USA does is sort of eliminate one particular nation and then move on to the other one. However, when the Southern Hemisphere countries decide to work together, that, I think, would be a real challenge, and it is proving to be a challenge to the U.S. might.
Well, Dan, about trying to prevent Iran from advancing technologically, according to Shabir, and the reality is that they have not been able to do that. So after more than 40 years of trying to pressure Iran, and they see that Iran continues advancing, one would think that perhaps they would try another method, because obviously that one hasn't worked. But we continue to see the same old, same old. I mean, why is that the case in your perspective?
Well, wasn't it Albert Einstein that said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and hoping for different results?
Right.
I think our leaders are insane. I mean, I'm sorry, they're not acting in any rational capacity. You know, Iran is willing to deal with the United States. It helped in the war on terror. And after the war on terror, Iran sent a proposal to the White House, proposing a grand bargain with the United States to try to deal with all the issues of mutual concern, and the U.S. never even responded to it. The fact is, the U.S. could work with Iran if it wanted to, and that would be the rational decision here. Instead, they continue to try to punish Iran, frankly, for having overthrown the U.S.-backed dictator in 1979, but this is not a rational policy. It's a policy of spite, a policy motivated by the desire for control. And given that, the U.S. just keeps moving forward with the same failed policies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, how much of the U.S. policies do you think, when we're looking at, whether we're talking about the relationship with Iran or specifically in dealing with the IAEA nuclear talks, how much do you think that the Zionist regime plays in all of this? That Washington is not particularly looking at what's perhaps best even for the American people or the United States, but more importantly, the interests of the regime in Tel Aviv?
Well, indeed, that is the reality of the situation, is that the Zionist entity's colonial sort of project, which was implanted by my government, by the British government, way back, nearly 100 years ago, when the Balfour Declaration was proposed, and under that auspices, the Zionist entity came into creation in 1948. And of course, American presidents continuously since that time have sort of put all the support that is required to sort of take away any blame from the rulers in Tel Aviv, whether it's the killing of Palestinians. I mean, since the beginning of this year, virtually every day an individual Palestinian has been killed and assassinated in the occupied territories. Recently, we had bombing taking place in Gaza, and this seems to be a sort of a regular feature every year. It continues. And I think the most telling comment really is from Netanyahu himself. Only recently, he said 95% of the threat to Israel comes from Iran. So, when the leader of a nation says that the main threat is from Israel, from Iran, then that shows clearly that the U.S. wants to protect Israel. And if tomorrow, let's say, you know, when the Reza Shah Pahlavi was in power, Iran had very good relationship with Israel, and oil was being supplied at a discounted rate. But as soon as Imam Khomeini came into power, that relationship was completely cut off, and that in itself has created huge problems for Iran. If tomorrow Iran decides to, have a diplomatic relationship with Israel, then you know, nuclear weapons, human rights issues, all kinds of things will be put on the back burner, and Iran would become part of the so-called, group of civilized nations.
Dan, how much of this is related to the hegemonic media there? We talked about, Shabir talked about the Israeli regime, and we talked about as far as the interests of Tel Aviv perhaps being more important sometimes to Washington than the United States itself. But isn't the reality is that the people of the United States have no idea of the reality, whether we're talking about Israel and Israeli crimes, whether we're talking about Iran and actually abiding by their commitments, or whether we're talking about the United States itself and not really abiding by its commitments. It is the reality is that the populace in the United States is extremely ignorant of the reality. Thus, no pressure actually is exerted against the government.
Well, of course, that's true. Americans are, I would say, uniquely ignorant in the world about many things, about history, about their own history, certainly world history, geography. Many Americans couldn't even find Iran on the map or even Israel on the map. You know, after 9/11, there was a popular country song where the singer says he doesn't know the difference between Iran and Iraq, and he said it proudly, you know. When you have that situation, an uninformed populace, of course, they won't push back on any of this because they have no idea about the long history, again, of the U.S. supporting the murderous Shah in Iran. They don't know why there was a revolution in 1979. They don't know that Iran has helped in the war on terror. They have they just know nothing. And given that, yeah, it's very hard for change to come to the United States.
You know, Dan, you just said something. I remember once I was in the States and actually at university and showing some slides on Iran, and this was on a university setting, and someone was surprised to know that people actually live in houses, in buildings. They were thinking that they lived in, like, deserts. Like, it was quite unbelievable to that level of a lack of knowledge of the reality of what happens in other countries. Well, Shabir, you've pointed to this, alluded to this earlier, about the rise of this multilateral world. There's the unilateral world is ending, and we're entering a new phase. Your perspective on how much this will change the reality on the ground, whether we're talking about IAEA or other organizations under the United Nations, because there is going to be a different dynamic, and it's already in the making. Your take.
Well, indeed, new dynamics is in the making. Obviously, because the whole sort of web that USA has created after the Second World War of United Nations, other organizations, as I've said, money sort of transferring through SWIFT, the banking system, and all sort of instruments that have been created, it's not easy technically to come out of that. But I think a great effort is being made by whether it's the BRIC countries or SCO or the Eurasian nations together to really challenge this hegemonic madness, if you like, whereby a particular nation feels that they have special rights and no one else has any other rights at all. And I think people have been really trying to create the situation for many years, but it was becoming difficult. However, we can see that lots of things have happened since the Ukraine war and sanctions on Russia, and then, of course, the whole issue of Taiwan and China, and continuously it carries on to sort of create this sort of war situation, a continuous sort of war footing that Washington wants to sort of have, because obviously it benefits the armaments trade and the military-industrial complex. But I think people of the world have really awakened that what is happening is not in their interest. And really, the situation is that only 15% of the global population lives in countries like the European Union, United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. 85% of the world population does not live in that particular region. And they have been deprived, manipulated, and the governments have been changed through color revolutions and all kinds of other manipulations. So I think we are living through extraordinary times, mm-hmm. not just interesting times, but extraordinary times where things are moving so rapidly right. that even analysts and commentators can't really keep pace with it. But I think it's a good omen for the world global population.
Okay. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Daniel Kovalek, professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. By the way, Dan, nice picture behind your head, like the painting. Shavir Rezvi, political analyst out of London. And as always, I appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزای لازمی است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran 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 کتاب
in the limelight.
A Guantanamo Bay prisoner is fighting to get his case heard in a London court of law after he alleged the United Kingdom was complicit in helping the US mistreat him. Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, a Saudi Arabian citizen, was first detained in Dubai in 2002 for his alleged involvement in two bombings targeting a US warship and a French civilian oil tanker. He's been held captive at the notorious Guantanamo Bay Military Detention Center in Cuba since 2006. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A Guantanamo Bay prisoner tortured by the CIA has accused British intelligence agencies of complicity in his mistreatment in a new case before one of UK's most secretive courts. Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, who is alleged by the United States to have plotted Al-Qaeda's bombing of an American naval ship, is seeking to persuade the court to consider his complaint against MI5, MI6, and GCHQ. Lawyers for Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, a 58-year-old, argued this week there was an unavoidable inference that the intelligence agencies were complicit in his torture, rendition, and mistreatment by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Abdulrahim al-Nashiri, a Saudi Arabian citizen, was first detained in 2002 as part of the CIA's post-9/11 secret detention and interrogation program. He is currently facing the death penalty before a US military commission over his alleged role in the 2000 bombing of an American naval ship. The British government is arguing that the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, the IPT, a special judicial body that investigates complaints against the intelligence services, does not have jurisdiction to hear Abdulrahim al-Nashiri's application. In papers submitted to the tribunal, al-Nashiri's barrister, Hugh Southey, KC, said, "The complaints case is that the British intelligence agencies aided, abetted, encouraged, facilitated and or conspired with the US authorities in his mistreatment. After his capture by the CIA, al-Nashiri was put into a network of secret prisons operated by the agency known as Black Sites in Afghanistan, in Thailand, and multiple Eastern European countries. A US Senate investigation into the CIA's post-9/11 detention program found that al-Nashiri was repeatedly tortured while held at the Black Sites. The so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used against him included waterboarding, mock executions, and rectal feeding. After being held for almost 4 years at secret CIA facilities, Abdulrahim al-Nashiri was transferred in 2006 to the notorious US military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. He has been detained there ever since. In al-Nashiri's complaint to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, his lawyer said he was of specific interest to British intelligence in the 2000s and probably part of a group of detainees in whose torture Britain was allegedly complicit. The lawyers alleged the British government's involvement in al-Nashiri's mistreatment probably included allowing Luton Airport to be used to refuel a private jet used in his rendition from Thailand to Poland in December of 2002. If al-Nashiri's case is allowed to proceed at the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, it could place the spotlight back on long-standing questions about Britain's alleged complicity in the CIA's detention program. In 2018, the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee concluded that the United Kingdom's spy agencies, MI5, MI6, were involved in the kidnapping and torture of terrorism suspects by the CIA and other partner intelligence services. However, the committee said its investigation had been terminated prematurely because of government obstruction and warned, "There are questions and incidents which therefore remain unanswered and uninvestigated." British ministers previously pledged to hold an independent, judge-led inquiry into the issue, but that commitment was abandoned back in 2019. Website of Redress, redress.org, a non-governmental organization which delivers justice and reparation for survivors of torture and advocates for legal and policy reforms to combat torture, has also covered this story and tells us more. The Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, the judicial body which probes complaints against the British intelligence services, has announced that it will investigate the complaint brought by Mustafa Al-Hosawi, a redress client, against the British intelligence services for their alleged complicity in his torture by US agents. Although the tribunal's investigations remain secretive and lack transparency, to the best of our knowledge, there have not been any previous full investigations undertaken by the tribunal in relation to those held in the CIA's Black Sites program. Mustafa Al-Hosawi has been detained at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba since 2006 after having been tortured for several years at Central Intelligence Agency's CIA's Black Sites. He was one of 14 high-value detainees transferred to the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, who were found to be at a particular risk of torture and ill-treatment by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Under the CIA's rendition, detention and interrogation program, Mustafa Al-Hosawi was subjected to so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which included, in his case, waterboarding, a technique used for torture of detainees, walling, attention grasps, facial holds, cramped confinements, psychological pressure, and sleep deprivation. Following these violations, Mustafa Al-Hosawi was diagnosed with chronic hemorrhoids. There is evidence to suggest the British intelligence agencies encouraged, facilitated, or conspired with US authorities in the torture and ill-treatment of high-value detainees within the CIA program. Following a hearing at the Royal Courts of Justice in London earlier this month, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, rejected arguments put forward by the British government lawyers that it did not have jurisdiction to consider the complaint. British government lawyers argued that it was a case which should have been brought in the High Court. However, the tribunal, whose investigative role differs from that of a normal court, decided that it should investigate the complaint in the usual way, that is, according to public law principles. The tribunal also exercised its discretion to allow the complaint to progress, despite the fact that it was made beyond the normal one-year limit period for filing complaints, noting the stringent communication restrictions on Mustafa Al-Hosawi, who is still at Guantanamo Bay, and the issues raised by the complaint, which are of the gravest possible kind. In its decision made public, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, said, "It is alleged that the intelligence services of Britain were complicit in torture by agents of the United States. If the allegations are true, it is imperative that that should be established. If they're not true, it is just as important that that should be made clear so as to maintain public confidence. We conclude that it will be in the public interest for these issues to be considered by this tribunal, which is a fair, independent, and impartial court." The complaint brought by Redress on behalf of Mustafa Al-Hosawi seeks to obtain documents and information held by the British intelligence agencies regarding Mustafa al-Houssawi's torture and ill-treatment, a declaration that British agencies or their agents were involved in his torture and ill-treatment and that their conduct was unlawful, and compensation for their conduct. Mustafa al-Houssawi faces capital charges before a US military commission at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for his alleged involvement as a financier of the 9/11 attacks in the United States. However, the redacted executive summary of the U.S. Select Committee on Intelligence on its investigation into the CIA's rendition, detention, and interrogation program identifies him as one of several individuals who were detained under the CIA's program despite doubts and questions surrounding his knowledge of terrorist threats and the location of senior al-Qaeda leadership. Redress has been representing Mustafa al-Houssawi since 2012, including in ongoing proceedings before the European Court of Human Rights.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.